Okay. Welcome back, everybody. Hope you had a good weekend. And this is the final lecture for 581. Congrats. Nearly made it through. One more hurdle left to go in the final project or exam, but nearly there. Okay, announcements. As I've said the last couple of classes, PCBs have all been ordered along with all the components. EECS shipping and receiving down in the parts store has told me they're willing to just distribute those directly. So you will hear from them as your parts and PCBs arrive and can pick them up directly from the parts store, but they'll email you directly. FPGAs and interface boards, for those of you doing the project, will be made available sometime today, sometime after lecture. I'm going to figure out a distribution system and post to Slack and let you know how you can pick those up. I don't want to do that in a way that minimizes any contact. These boards have been used for a couple of years in this class. In the first year, I handed out just blank PCBs and components to populate them. So what you get may be fully populated, may have only had two or four channels populated, depending on what sort of topology it's been used for in the past. So I will make those available. I think for most of you, based on the topologies you have, you should be able to have one that is populated in so far as you need it to be. Only one of you will need all eight channels, and I've got at least one that's just fully populated. But they will be in various states, and there will be an FPGA and an interface board, and then components available if you need additional ones to populate it. But as in the past, you don't need to fully populate the board just to have it fully populated. You're welcome to only use what you need on it. All of these eight isolated supply and PWM channels can operate independently without the others being soldered on. We've shown pictures in lecture, but looks like this when the two boards are stacked together. So you have the FPGA board with the USB on the backside. It can be used to program it. Stacking them together, what you need to be careful about is doing it the correct way so you don't short anything out. The correct way, there's a couple ways to know it. One is, as they stack together, that USB port should still be accessible. See, the interface board is a little bit longer than the FPGA. And because it's not keyed in any way, I can plug this up backwards, and powering it after doing so will damage something because the power supply will be shorted out. You can tell it's the wrong way because the USB is now underneath this dangling edge of the interface board and harder to access. Another way to tell is the interface board will have pins for all of the ground connections on the FPGA, and those are all up here at the top. So these little sets of four square headers should plug in up at the top where all the ground pins are, ground and supply. So make sure you plug that in correctly so that nothing gets damaged. Once you do that, you should have up to eight isolated supply and PWM channels, and can start from the example code and debug that you get the PWMs you need out of it, and then begin adjusting duty cycles and phase shifts and dead times from there. Okay. Questions on that? So figure out somewhere that I can place these things that you all have access to, and then I'll let you know via Slack where those are. Obviously not required or expected to work on this over Thanksgiving break, but based on the request we had in Slack from a student, I'll try to make those available today. If you want to pick them up next week when you get back from Thanksgiving break, or you're welcome to do that. As I mentioned before, TN voice evaluations are now available. Please do fill those out. This link had one more, so we're currently 2 out of 6, but I'd like to get to 100% completion. Please fill that out before December 1st. So this being the last lecture, I just want to talk about what's left. We just mentioned TN voice for everybody. And then for the rest of you, remaining requirements are either track one or track two. Track one, if you're doing the PCB testing, you have a final testing report due on December 9th. For the most part, that should just directly follow the format available on the website. Just plug in your numbers and take your screenshots and put them on there. I don't want you to put a short additional narrative if something doesn't correspond to your predictions, if it ends up being much lower efficiency or you run into problems with certain behaviors. I want you to try to explain what you were seeing and what happened there. This should not be verbose. It should be short and concise, but just getting across the point of, here's what I ran into. I tried to do this. That had some impact, but in the end, I wasn't able to get the performance I thought, but I think I know why. Okay. If you plug it all together and it works exactly as expected, you don't need to put anything here. Fine. For track two, if you have opted to take the final exam, I'll post that on Monday after Thanksgiving. It'll also be due on December 9th. Same rules and format as the midterm exam. No outside assistance, but you can use your notes, use the course website, use the PowerBook or the online version of it if you have it. It is comprehensive. Everything from every lecture in the course is fair game for that. Okay, any questions or comments related to anything for the remainder of the course?
Dr. Costanet, I have a question.
Go ahead, Dennis.
So for the project for TinyBox, What if we get it? What if we get things to work, but in a way different from initially designed?
Go ahead and detail that concisely. Give me a short write-up of what you did and why.
Yeah.
Again, not looking for pages here. Half a page is fine. Just something so that I understand what happened, what problems you ran into, and what you did or what you think you understand about them between your design and what you're eventually turning in as your final results.
Yeah, because further analysis after boards have been ordered has indicated that may be required in my case. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And that's all, you know, if things are vastly different. So if you thought the dead time was going to be 10 nanoseconds and you end up using 12 nanoseconds, no need to specifically write anything about that. But if you thought you were going to run at a megahertz and you turn in something at 100 kilohertz, give me an explanation of what happened and why you ended up doing that.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Anybody else? Normal, I do have the Slido open. If you want to post anything anonymously throughout the lecture, feel free to. I'll respond to those as I see them. Otherwise, feel free to jump in at any moment, but I'll continue on with wrapping up some of the discussion for this final lecture then. So last time we were continuing on talking about this discrete time analysis framework, showing some comparison between average modeling and this idea of discrete time modeling. So in average modeling, it is kind of took state space descriptions of the two circuits, two subintervals and a buck converter. And we can kind of extend this to any number of subintervals. If we have a DCM buck, we'd have three. And in order to get a LTI model or some model of the net behavior of the circuit that got rid of this time varying nonlinearity, what we did is we just averaged the state space descriptions together. So just kind of weight each of the different state space descriptions in each of the subintervals by the percent of the period that it's in that subinterval, add them all up, and then that's a description of some equivalent average system. Okay. And it turns out that's the same average system that we've been doing since our undergrad intro to power electronics course. We got there through state space analysis rather than waveform averaging or switch averaging, but it gets us to the same point. Looking at it this way draws out a little bit more of what are the approximations made in that process. Looking at averaging, what's averaging do is it simplifies the problem by getting rid of all this switching ripple and all of its harmonics. But the problem there is that that's not real. That's something we are doing after the fact to our circuit model. And so getting rid of those things inserts some averaged gain into our model that is not part of the real physical system. It means it's going to obfuscate behaviors in the converter that are present in the hardware when we build it, but won't be present in our model. Okay. Good and bad with that. Good thing is it makes it more simple. We get a nice LTI system. We don't have to worry about all this high frequency stuff. Bad thing is, okay, if we try to push our closed loop bandwidth up into this range, or if we're at all interested in dynamics up here, they're gone and we don't know how the circuit's actually gonna behave up here. Okay. Then we started talking about how fundamentally a power converter has some sampling type behaviors. It has some discrete time nature to it, in that every period we get to decide on one duty cycle, or if we're talking about a DAB, we get to decide on one phase shift. Even if we have multiple controls, if we're doing duty cycle and phase shift control in the DAB, we still have to decide on them once per period. We can't continuously vary that. We can't select four different duty cycles within one period. Once we switch, we're done switching for that period. We wait for the next period to make a new control action. So there is some switching frequency type sampling behavior of these systems inherently. And we went on to talk about discrete time modeling, which with this recognition models the converter in a discrete time framework. And the way it works is simply using the state space description, we just solve the state space equation in each sub interval, then plug everything up where the initial condition for this switching state is the final value of the previous switching state. Going through that for any number of switching subintervals, we can just plug them in kind of recursively and end up with a formulation that solves in closed form what are the states at the end of the period from the states at the beginning of the period and whatever the inputs to the system are. We can go through and plug in and just jump from this point x of zero to x of ts, solve directly from this initial condition what are the states at the end of the period. Okay. Generally, it looks like this. If we do it for an arbitrary number, n sub sw of switching subintervals, so two for a buck, three for a DCM buck, depending on how we model it, could be eight for a DAB in phase shift modulation as we've looked at it, if we consider both dead times, both phase shift intervals, and both power delivery intervals. Depending on the topology and the modulation could be a different number. Things are, in fact, relatively simple, look a little bit complicated because we've got matrix exponentials and this sum of products going on, but not too bad to calculate numerically. It's going to be less analytical than our average modeling. Not going to be able to get kind of a nice simple expression that we can manipulate into an equivalent circuit in most cases. It's going to be a heavily numerical calculation that just gives us numerically, here's what these states are. Okay. There's a couple more things I want to talk about related to this, and then we'll kind of show some example applications and conclude on discrete time modeling. So from here, this is really just without any approximation, an expression that tells us the states at the end of the period from the states at the beginning of the period. It's large signal, it hasn't been linearized into small signal, it hasn't been given an averaging approximation, or it's not limited really by any approximation. Similar to what we've done with averaging, we kind of want to do two things. One is steady state type analysis, saying, okay, just in steady state, what are the operating waveforms of the converter? That'll help us design it, figure out what the losses are, predict an efficiency. And then in control design, we want some kind of small signal transfer function that we can use in order to do compensator design and design a stable closed loop control. And so we can do both of those things within this framework. For small signal modeling, This is now in discrete time, an LTI system with respect to the states and the inputs. What's hidden in there is what happens when our duty cycle varies, and we have to pull that out and look at some sort of linearization. So it's nonlinear with respect to variations in the control parameters, duty cycles, and switching times. And the process of finding that coefficient gamma of the duty cycle is going to be a little bit different than with our average modeling, but not so bad. We can also look at the large signal first. So if we have this closed form expression that tells us what the states at the end of the period are as a function of the states at the beginning of the period and the inputs, in steady state, the states at the end of the period should be the states at the beginning of the period. It's the definition of steady state. So the initial condition for the next period is the same as for this one. So then all the periods are going to look the same. So if that's the case, then we can just solve and plug in, okay, x of ts is equal to x of naught. Subtract this term over to the left, factor it out, and then multiply this I minus this product here back over to the right. All we get is a closed form expression for what the steady state initial condition of the period is. Okay, so now knowing these A matrices and B matrices, if we have our state space description for every subinterval and we know the times that we're in that subinterval, we plug that all up here, gives us the steady state solution. Okay. Not bad. This is generic for any topology. Doesn't matter whether this is a switched cap or an AC link or a buck converter. It also is not limited by any sort of idealized approximations. So we don't need high Q resonance. We don't need zero losses. We don't need fundamental harmonic only. We don't need straight line ripple. It's whatever the circuit is, whatever the dynamics of it are, this gives you the steady state solution. So a little bit complicated looking equation, but super powerful for solving a steady state. Just plug everything in, you get it back exactly with all your loss mechanisms in there with multiple resonances or single resonances or no resonances. Okay. So that's large signal modeling. It's all in closed form. For small signal modeling, we need to kind of develop a method to deal with this kind of hidden variation of a duty cycle. Okay, so if we take this formulation up here and say the duty cycle varies, varying the duty cycle, let's jump back to here, we'll be moving this point left or right, where is DTS? And what that'll do is extend one time. You know, if we increase D here, this switching interface would move to the right by D hat TS, which means we'd spend a little bit more time in this state over here and a little bit less time in this state over here if we have a constant switching frequency. So what would happen, assuming we have the same initial condition, kind of come up, grid. And instead of switching at this time, we would continue on with the dynamics of state one for a little bit longer, then go into state two, and we would have the dynamics of state two through the end of the period. So to develop a small signal model, what I want to know is from this small signal change in duty cycle, what is the resulting change x hat of TS? Some small perturbation in my control parameter, how much do my states vary? Okay. If I can solve that, I'll get in my LTI system this parameter gamma, which is telling me how much do my states change as a result of a change in duty cycle. Okay. And since this is a small signal model, we can make some approximations, assuming that this perturbation here is infinitesimally small around our steady state operating point, just linearize at that point. Okay. So the process of finding that really just comes off solving this figure that I just drew. So I'll draw it a little bit more cleanly here. So if I have some perturbation in duty cycle, stay in state one a little bit longer, spend a little bit less time in state two. Because this DHAT is infinitesimally small, the actual durations of either of these periods are negligibly affected. So capital DTS, capital D prime TS are changed by some infinitesimally small amount. We're just going to look at the linearized impact there. Okay. So given that DHAT is extremely small, I can solve, okay, what is this thing here? The amount of change in the states that happens just at the end of this DHAT period. And for that, because D is infinitesimally small, I can make this kind of first order approximation where I say, okay, right here in the dynamics of subinterval one, and say x one dot is equal to a one x of DTS plus b1 times u. And that would be describing the system over this little segment. Well, I know the slope there. And if this time is so short that that slope doesn't have any change in it, so as I let that time go small, as we go over an entire period here, you see the slope is changing a little bit if we don't make any approximation. But if this time is let be infinitesimally small, I really only care about the slope directly at this point. And then that would be this constant value. And then we would have that slope times this infinitesimally small time perturbation would tell us how far up we went during d hat ts. Okay, so this term here is my x1 dot, and I multiply it by this time to tell me how far up I went right here. And then I want to figure out the difference between that and how far and what I would have done if I hadn't perturbed the duty cycle. So I subtract from that this thing, which is x dot and two times the same time, which is how far down I would have gone if I hadn't perturbed. And the difference between those two is what is the difference in the states right at this time. So that tells me right here, as I perturb the duty cycle, what is the impact on the states of the system. Then all I need to do is get that to the end of the period instead. After this, little d hat ts interval, then either way, with my unperturbed system and my perturbed system, they're just in subinterval two until the end of the period. So I can just propagate those states through e to the a2 t2, same way we solve the steady state, same way we've analyzed the system up to this point. We just propagate through the matrix exponential. So we multiply this x d hat, which is this whole expression, the difference between these two, by the matrix exponential of all of the following intervals. In this case, there's just one after this perturbation, just subinterval two. And if I plug that up now, plug x d hat in here, then I'll have these d hat ts times these slopes multiplied by this matrix exponential. And what I'll get is the perturbation at the end of the period as a function of this d hat. Okay. Plug that all together for this two subinterval converter perturbing the duty cycle. Gamma is this expression. Simplifies a bit as I plug these two things together. I've got x of DTS and u in both, so I collect terms there. Xd, this is x of DTS in steady state. Nomenclature here, and that gives me gamma, and now I have a complete small signal model of the system. Okay. it's in discrete time. Again, we got to use the Z transform to work with this and design a controller around it. But now I have an LTI small signal model that I can assess stability and design a compensator for. Okay. A couple of example results here. These are from this book listed at the bottom, Digital Control of High Frequency Switch Mode Power Converters by Luca Corradini, Dragan Maximovich, Regan Zane, and Paolo Montevelli. So they're looking at just a buck converter here with some resistance on the inductor, some ESR of the capacitor loaded by a current source. And here we're looking at the transfer function from, they call it GVU, but it's from the control input, the duty cycle, to the output voltage, using an average model and a discrete time model. And in general, the discrete time model is going to be more accurate because it doesn't have the averaging approximation in it. It's going to correctly take into account sampling behaviors of this converter and be full signal, include ripple and everything else. So when we look at this transfer function, you see is okay, at low frequency up to about the switching frequency, a decade below the switching frequency should be FS, excuse me, not TS. These things basically overlap, particularly on the magnitude and then the phase, a little bit less so, but the average model and the discrete time model give you almost the same thing. As I start to push beyond the switching frequency divided by 10, if I wanted to design a closed loop bandwidth closer to the switching frequency over 5 or even half the switching frequency, you see is that there's a significant difference in terms of phase, minor difference in magnitude here, but the phase starts to roll off pretty quickly in the discrete time model, whereas it stays more or less flat in the average model. And this is why you can't use the average model up here. If I designed a system where I put my, say, closed loop bandwidth right here, designed it to have, say, 45 degrees of phase margin, and I'm happy with that, and come down here and look at the difference between what my average model tells me the phase is and what my discrete time model tell me the phase actually is, there's almost 90 degrees of additional phase lag there that I wouldn't see if I was just using the average model. So if I designed this thing using the average model for this sort of a crossover frequency in my loop gain, 45 degrees of phase margin, I'd actually be very unstable, minus 45 degrees of real phase margin. Okay. But push back here and stay at least a decade below the switching frequency, it might have maybe 10 degrees of additional phase lag. And if I design for 45 degrees of phase margin, I actually only get 35 degrees of phase margin. Performs a little worse than I thought it would, but stays stable. Relatively minor difference there. And in this case, for this simple buck converter, it is relatively well approximated by the average model. Most of this deviation has to do with the sampling effect and the delay in the feedback loop of this design. The sampling effect that we talked about in the PWM has some one control action per period, and that actually has an impact on the equivalent delay when you get up into these frequencies. So one thing they do in this book is they say, okay, if I take the average model and just add an equivalent delay to it, I get something that matches pretty well up to about a fifth of the switching frequency. It takes into account most of the difference between these two is just the delay and the sampling effect of the PWM. That is true for this buck converter that has relatively small ripple, looking at the controlled output transfer function. Even in this converter, if I look at a different transfer function, this is a control the duty cycle to output current transfer function, what you see is that the average model can't actually predict the dynamics of that. The discrete time model, even at low frequencies, is a better approximation or a better, has the full dynamics and is actually a valid model of what the converter is doing, while the average model misses some dynamics. This has to do with the average model to trying to take into account the switching actions and the impact of the controller on that. Basically, when you do current mode control in a buck converter, makes most of the dynamics go away. When you look at the real thing with the discrete time model, you get a more accurate depiction of the dynamics of this thing, even at low frequency. Some of those impacts of high frequency behaviors reflect down on the steady state operating point and what the DC gain is. So really this average model has some approximations built in. This averaging is not actually going on in the converter. It's something that makes the analysis simpler. It's really good in that it makes things simple and can lead to nice expressions, can lead to analytical transfer functions that you can use to see how things, how different parameters are impacting your behaviors. But particularly in designs where we want to push up to some more advanced operation or higher bandwidth, we have to be very careful with the average model and knowing where it applies and where it's errant, where that averaging approximation is going to cause problems. Discrete time model, a little bit more complicated, but it just works. It doesn't care if things are small ripple or not, if they're damped or not. It's just solving really the differential equations of the converter in closed form. Okay, so that's all an example from this book, focuses on the buck converter, which is many ways for how we're talking about it, not the right example to use. So I want to kind of summarize, and then I'll show a couple other examples of applying discrete time modeling. Summary here. So this is the steady state large signal solution using discrete time modeling. Small signal, there's not as much a single expression to point to, but rather this process of deriving the transfer function by looking at the impact of the perturbation and propagating it to the end of the period. But with it, we can solve both large signal and small signal behaviors of an arbitrary converter. It's valid for any converter. The only things we need to set this up are that the inputs are constant within one switching interval. Easier if they're constant over one switching period, but still works even if you had to have some subscript here and say UI, whatever the constant input is during each switching subinterval, no modification needed. We do need to know all of the times of each of these switching subintervals. If we have something like a DCM buck converter, that can require some additional analysis to figure out how long the diode is on for. Generally with our MOSFETs, it's easy to know when they turn on, when they turn off, because we have some external signal telling it to turn on or turn off in the VGS waveform. But diodes can require some additional analysis to make sure that we know when they turn off if we're operating in DCM, or when they turn on if they're forward biased by some waveform. And as long as we can break this thing up into a sequence of linear subcircuits, which is basically how we analyze every power converter, by breaking it up into a sequence of LTI circuits at time. We have to find these state matrices that can be automated. There are tools out there that just, you can sketch a circuit schematic and they'll give you back these matrices. And it has, the main issue is that it is not as design oriented as average modeling. What I mean by that is it is not going to give you nice, simple analytic equations. In the end, you can solve a transfer function, but you're going to get a numerical transfer function. You're not going to get something where you can say, hey, the resonant frequency is 1 over root LC and the Q is R over L. You are going to need to examine numerically, and if you want to figure out the impact of certain elements on those transfer functions or behaviors, you have to do it numerically by varying them or examining sensitivity with respect to those parameters. Okay. So I'm showing an example of applying this to the dual active bridge converter. Some work from the publication down here at the bottom. I think I've shown this prototype and some waveforms from it before in this class when we were talking about dual active bridges, but this is 150 to 12 volts, 120 watts at 1 megahertz. And in this one, since it's a high step down, the waveforms kind of looked like this. We're including the ZVS behaviors during the dead times of the primary and secondary side devices. because the primary is high voltage, low current. It has these real slow ZVS transitions. Secondary is low voltage, high current. So it gets very fast ZVS transitions. They're almost instantaneous at 10 amps and just 12 volts at the output. This is talking about the linearization of this matrix exponential function and showing this point I made earlier about can it be approximated with a shortened Taylor series. So what this is these same waveforms. I've taken kind of this section here of the waveforms, and I'm just breaking apart each subinterval. So this top row is, here's the ZVS transition on the primary side voltage, goes from 150 down to minus 150, and then stays flat through the next two subintervals here. For the output voltage, this is all zoomed in to show a little bit of ripple on it. For the inductor current, it kind of resonates down, then ramps linearly, and then has this flat interval. So kind of resonates down, ramps linearly, then has this flat interval. Okay, so I'm breaking apart by subinterval and by waveform. And then each of these blue lines is what I get when I predict the behavior using the matrix exponential. And so that's the exact solution to the differential equation. It's the exact waveform that I would get under the circuit approximation I have. Okay. If I approximate instead of by the full matrix exponential, just by the first two terms in the Taylor series, this is the approximation that's inherent to average modeling, saying that it is a constant slope during every subinterval. What I get are these green waveforms. And you can see during anything where it is more or less constant slope, like the inductor current during the phase shift or the primary side voltage when it's not resonating, when it's just held constant, the constant slope approximation is okay. So it can model kind of some of these states and some of these subintervals reasonably well. But anything where I've got any type of resonant behavior, any type of curvature to the waveform, this is not a good approximation. And average modeling is going to be a big problem if we try to apply it to those segments of the waveform. Okay. Even if I go to a second order Taylor series approximation where I add this second order term in the expansion of the matrix exponential, that does is it'll help me in some subintervals. So these two now, this red waveform is reasonably close to the blue one. The inductor current, as it's resonating, it's kind of arguable whether that's close enough. Things like the primary side voltage, capacitor voltage, and the output voltage ripple, this is clearly not a good approximation of what's going on there. So when we have resonant type behaviors, this sort of linearization that is inherent to average modeling is going to lose the dynamics of the converter. It's not going to show what impact those have. Okay. Here we've already looked at, so if I solve this thing using state plane analysis, we've done this, I can go through and solve the DAB using state plane, assuming that I've got relatively low losses, this will be a good approximation of the waveforms. Comes a big problem when I start looking at what happens across a variety of different input output voltages and a variety of different loading conditions though. Okay. We've really talked about phase shift modulation at reasonably high power where ZVS is obtained in the dual active bridge. But if I start decreasing the power level, eventually I lose ZVS. I can then change things around so that the secondary dead time starts before the end of the phase shift interval. I get a operating mode and a state plane that looks like this. I go from primary dead time directly into secondary dead time without any phase shift interval independent in there. Mode four, if I have a primary and then a secondary dead time and then a phase shift interval after I hard switch some. So I can get all sorts of different, more complicated state planes, and I can go through and solve all these state planes for the dual active bridge using state plane analysis and get a full depiction of the operating mode. And that's some results using that here, showing at 120 watts and then down at 0 watts output power. I get some hard switching on the secondary, but due to the non-unity normalized conversion ratio, can maintain soft switching on the primary. And can use that and then back out from the state plane analysis using this high efficiency approximation, then go back and solve losses and get a reasonable model of this thing. In terms of small signal behaviors, state plane analysis doesn't really lend itself well to small signal analysis. It can be done. We talked about it a little bit in the course, particularly just for these resonant switch topologies where we replace a PWM type switch network with a resonant switching network in a parent PWM topology, any sort of two switched buck boost, juke sepik type converter. For something like the dual actor bridge, how do we go from this solution in our state plane analysis to a small signal model? We can certainly do that as long as we have a mathematical description of the behavior. We can start taking partial derivatives with respect to all the parameters to get our small signal linearization. But that's a bit of a pain in state plane analysis, particularly because usually we don't get a closed form solution out of state plane analysis because we have transcendental equations. We just have a network, a group of equations, system of equations describing the operation. So if we want to look at small signal modeling and start taking partial derivatives of that system of equations, it can be a bit of a pain. So here, to get a small signal model, this dual actor bridge, this work, use this discrete time modeling framework. This is showing as a step in the load at two different steady state operating points at a lower power and a higher power. And these red squares are the discrete time predictions, the sampling points of the discrete time model. And then blue is the experimental waveforms of this converter. You can see in this discrete time modeling framework, it predicts exactly what's going to happen in the output voltage and inductor current, a couple of different transfer functions using the discrete time model. But it is limited in that it is single points. So we pick one point per switching period that the discrete time model uses to describe the behavior. So over here on the left at low power, I picked the time where it is the peak inductor current. So these red points kind of track the peak inductor current. Over here on the right, we have a bit of a different dynamic. And as the output voltage changed, the slope during the power delivery interval of that current changed. And because I'm always sampling at the same time, these points are initially the peak current, but really they're defined as just the current at the end of that power delivery interval as we go into the primary dead time. So it's the peak here, but then as the slope changes, it's not the peak anymore. It's still correctly predicting what is the state at this time. But now that during the power delivery interval, these current waveforms are sloping down, it's no longer the peak current. You can see the dynamics that I see out of this, these red squares might be a little bit misleading as to what the dynamics of the actual current are, even though they are correct and matching up. They're predicting what the current is at this specific time within each period. Okay. Alpha voltage, because it's relatively small ripple, is predicted pretty well in either case. Okay. Also look at the comparison to what would happen if I did an average model. An average model of a DAB, it's got a little bit of a trick to it because averaging through those AC waveforms in the middle would set them all to zero. So instead we only apply averaging at the DC ports, average the output, you just get some average current that depends on phase shift, and then all of the dynamics of the converter are just that average current feeding into the output capacitor. So you just get a 1/SC type transfer function multiplied by some gain. So that's what this purple line is. These black dots are the actual measured transfer function of the converter. You can see the discrete time model predicts those almost perfectly. This average model's not even close, doesn't have any idea of what the real dynamics of the system are. Because averaging through the tank just destroys it, gets rid of any sort of dynamics in the tank, and all we get is a current source feeding a capacitor at the output. So, we go through all this effort of solving the state plane for all of these different modes to get our steady state operation and then find something else to do the small signal modeling of it. Advantage of this discrete time framework is that, okay, whether we're in any of these different modes, whether we're hard switching, soft switching, high efficiency, not, whether we've got damping or multiple resonances, it's all treated uniformly. This equation is equally valid as long as we describe what the switching sequence is and have these descriptions of the equivalent subcircuit during each subinterval. It also doesn't matter that it was a DAB, doesn't matter what class or type of converter it is, whether it's some AC link or a switch cap or a hybrid switch cap, something like the multi-resonant buck converter we had trouble with in state plane analysis because there are multiple resonances, quasi-resonant PWM, all of it works uniformly in this discrete time framework. One other final example, just to give another one, one of these hybrid switch capacitor converters, in this case, a 4-to-1 hybrid Dixon with some PWM control to give me a 48-to-5-volt output. Here's an experimental prototype of it, plugging in and modeling it in this discrete time framework. We can predict the efficiency very well in a large signal model. To do this, there was no need to do any additional computation. I can just put all of the ESRs and the switch resistance into my state space description, solve the steady state, and then average the waveforms to get the efficiency. Matches up really well with an experimental prototype here. Okay, so a couple examples. That's the conclusion of my talk on discrete time modeling. It's a very powerful framework, said for a lot of details on how to use it to treat different cases. I teach a course on it. That's my 692 that'll hopefully be offered next fall. Here, I've kind of mentioned it and talked through it briefly in these last few lectures. Give you an idea of what else is out there beyond what we've talked about in this course. We've got state plane analysis, sinusoidal analysis, done a little bit of small signal modeling, but it was specific to these resonant switch networks. Can be applied in parent PWM topologies. To kind of round out discrete time modeling, you can cover the rest of things. How do we do small signal models of other topologies? And then can we have a uniform analysis framework across all of these? We can. It's discrete time modeling, very powerful and works well. Sacrifices having analytical equations in most cases. It's generally, these matrix exponentials for anything above about a 2x2 matrix are hard to compute analytically. So everything ends up just becoming numerical results. MATLAB can be useful, but it's a bit less intuitive. So in there, very briefly, I want to look at this and kind of offer some final thoughts on this course. We call it high frequency power electronics. And like I mentioned on the first day of class, it's not a great name for the course because high frequency is never a good thing. Hopefully went through, we've seen it complicates things and it makes things harder to design. High frequency is something that we endure in order to get advantageous behaviors out of the converter. Most often that looks something like this plot where we're looking at the efficiency of the converter versus the power density. If we want to go for miniaturization, as we go to higher switching frequency, we're pushing this direction along one of these curves, our Pareto front type curves. Going to higher switching frequency, we end up hurting our efficiency due to higher switching losses, but can use smaller passives and get up to higher power density. Okay. Then if we want to push beyond any single curve, we have to start looking at changes in how we operate converters. So if I have just a hard switched buck, that might be, for example, this red curve here. Then if I jump to a soft switched, zero voltage switching quasi square wave or quasi resonant buck, that'll put me on a different curve where I have a different relationship with switching frequency, maybe able to get higher efficiency or higher power density, or perhaps both if it's truly just a better topology. But we're always looking at how much should we increase switching frequency? How far should we push things? Well, as far as this gets you some design benefit, as far as this lets you miniaturize something, lets you stay small and get higher efficiency, lets you optimize on this trade-off in some way. So with that, let's jump over this and conclude there. I wanna thank you all for your hard work. I know this has been a particularly difficult semester for all of us, the pandemic and everything else going on. I appreciate you sticking it out. Still one more hurdle to go in the final exam and final project. Just do your best to make it through that. I appreciate, in spite of everything, the effort that all of you have continued to put in this course. So enjoy Thanksgiving break. Enjoy the rest of your week. Exam will come out as stated. I'll continue to be available through the end of the semester via Slack, via email, via Zoom if you schedule something with me. We can talk anytime if you have questions or want to talk about anything. Otherwise, thanks again for your work. Good luck on the finals in this class and in others. Thanks.